The meeting will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Fritz, will you move the minutes of the March 4th meeting? All right. Any questions on that, members? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. Motion prevails. One vote. Okay. Two votes. Okay. And I'm also right now, just before we get to Representative Clark's bill, I'm going to move that House File 384 be brought up for consideration. And then I'd like to delete Section 2 of House File 30, of House File 384. And then we're going to lay this on the table. We're not doing anything more with the bill today. I just want to get rid of that section. Any discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. And then I move the 384 be laid on the table. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. Representative Clark, I will move 286 be recommended to pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm really pleased to bring this bill before you today, both because of what the bill does and because it is also a memorial to a very good friend, Edith Davis, who is one of the pioneers of starting acupuncture as a licensed profession and just really bringing the whole area of acupuncture into the light of day and making sure that we have good standards and so on. And Edith is, was a friend who lives in South Minneapolis. Her daughter, Barbara, is actually here with us today. She's also acupuncturist. I'd like to recognize her. And we're going to go forward and talk about the bill. Basically, what we're trying to ensure here is consumers' rights, equal access to licensed acupuncture practitioners in the same way that we have the law for other non-physician health care providers like chiropractors and others. So I wanted to just go through the bill very quickly. The first section deals with the health insurance coverage of acupuncture, that it must requires that health insurance must cover acupuncture in the same way if it were must cover acupuncture the same way it's performed by a licensed acupuncture practitioner if the services are provided within the scope of practice. But I need to make sure that people really understand in looking at the bill is that it very clearly says, and I believe two different places in the bill, and I'm pointing this out because of several conversations with members of the committee, very clearly says that we are not intending to change or add to the benefits provided for any of the existing policies. We're just saying that if acupuncture is covered in those policies, then access to a licensed acupuncturist should be part of what is provided in that policy. It also has a section that says that if it's going to be a denial of benefits, then acupuncturists themselves need to be involved in that actual looking at the appropriateness of that denial. The last part deals with making sure that health maintenance organizations have the same type of access, equal access to acupuncturists. Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I'd like to have a couple of witnesses testify today, and we'll start with Kimberly Fritz.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, some members of the committee, my name is Kimberly Fritz. I'm a licensed acupuncturist and president of the Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine Association of Minnesota. The Equal Access to Acupuncture Bill is a consumer-focused bill. Its intent is to provide the opportunity to the consumers who already are paying for coverage of acupuncture within their health plan to utilize the experts in this field, the licensed acupuncturists. We've designated this bill as equal access because currently some health plans covering acupuncture restrict the consumer from seeking this important therapy from those specializing in this field, thus limiting the consumer's access. Currently, these health plans require that acupuncture therapy be provided by a medical doctor or a doctor of chiropractic and do not include the option to seek therapy from a licensed acupuncturist whose training in this field far exceeds that of other health professionals. This bill is not in any way a mandate. We are not asking to force coverage that currently isn't available. We are only trying to provide our patients with the opportunity to receive the best acupuncture care possible from those who have dedicated their time, study, and training on this specialty. This bill is not about efficacy. If efficacy was in question, the health plans wouldn't already cover it. The health plans which already cover acupuncture have obviously done their research and determined this therapy to be cost-effective and therapeutic, or they wouldn't already cover acupuncture. It is my understanding that health plans such as Cigna and Aetna have derived their acupuncture cover policies in part based on the wealth of research archived by the National Institutes of Health. Furthermore, our own U.S. Armed Forces are training their medics and physicians in acupuncture. Clearly, efficacy is not in question. This is evidence-based medicine. We hope you will support our bill, which will allow the consumer to make the choice to receive this important therapy from the experts in the field, your licensed acupuncturist.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either to the witness or to Representative Clark, I think the witness just testified that this is not a mandate. If that's true, then why do we have the bill?
It is my understanding that there are concerns that we are pushing to mandate coverage. In other words, we're trying to say that acupuncture must be covered. That is not what we're saying. We're saying when acupuncture is currently covered in a health care policy, that a licensed acupuncturist should be as easily reimbursed for that care as is an MD, a DO, or a DC.
So if a health plan can choose not to cover acupuncture, if they so choose?
Correct.
Representative Emmer.
Well, if that's the case, again, then what's the purpose for the bill? I'm not following. I guess my question is more to if insurance companies, health insurers, can already decide what they want to offer and what they don't want to offer, then why do I need to vote for a bill to make them offer something that they can already
currently decide? The health care plans that offer coverage for acupuncture, many of them restrict this service to be provided by only a medical doctor or a doctor of chiropractic. Leaving out the licensed acupuncturist who has 2,500 plus hours of training versus perhaps a chiropractor who has 100-hour certification. There's a large disparity in training and care. So the insurance companies are willing to reimburse someone who has as little as 100 hours, but not willing to reimburse someone who has over 2,500 hours.
Mr. Chair, are we going to be able to hear from somebody in the insurance?
Plenty of people.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Abler.
Well, just to keep the thing global here, I have 200 hours myself. Ironically, these acupuncturists that are licensed under the Board of Medical Practice are the highest trained, short of the Chinese ones who come in having had careers in this, who may or may not even qualify to be licensed under the board. But these acupuncturists licensed under the Board of Medical Practice under very high standards, ironically, are not allowed to get reimbursed, and often their prices are lower and they're far more qualified. So that's the purpose. And I don't know why we need a bill. I just thought they would do it. I was the author of this bill before, but the plans are unwilling to do it, and I think if they did it, they'd save money. So that's the reason we have to help them do the right thing, I guess, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fritz, a couple of other questions for clarification. Currently, those plans, and Cigna and Aetna, I believe, are two of the types of plans that you referred to earlier. You referred to them for other reasons, for ones that actually limit it to chiropractors and doctors. Within their practices, though, do they also use licensed acupuncturists to perform those services? Does the billing go through them?
It is my understanding that those plans will indicate that if a licensed acupuncturist is under the supervision of a physician, it can be reimbursable. However, and I think one of the other testifiers, Dr. Green, will speak to this, there are very few opportunities for a patient to access that sort of care. There are very few acupuncturists working under the supervision of a medical doctor.
Representative Bunn, we may get some of the questions answered by the next witness as well, but Representative Bunn.
I'll wait till the end.
Representative Liebling? Okay. Why don't we go to the next witness? Thank you.
Thank you.
And she'll be still, you'll still be here, Ms. Fritz, right?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Charles Sawyer, and I'm Senior Vice President of Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. I'm also a chiropractic doctor. Northwestern is a regionally accredited and federally funded research institution that trains acupuncturists, chiropractic doctors, and massage therapists. We also provide fee-based healthcare services, including acupuncture, in university-owned clinics in Bloomington, Burnsville, and on the Woodlands Hospital campus in Woodbury, where we actually have two clinicians that are working directly in the hospital with very minimal medical supervision. We also have clinical affiliations with Health East, the Benedictine Health System, Courage Center, Minnesota Oncology and Hematology Regions, and Abbott Northwestern Hospitals, and finally, Volunteers of America. I'm also here to support House File 286 because without this legislation, patients will continue to be denied full access to practitioners by virtue of their significant training, are highly qualified to provide care for a broad range of health problems. Care that is affordable, rarely associated with complications, effective for many patients, and supported by an expanding scientific literature. Most importantly, it is a very personal, patient-centered form of health care. By law, licensed acupuncturists can practice independently without referral, and their low malpractice insurance rates are evidence of their track record of providing safe care. And as a practical matter, most patients see them last. You will likely hear objections that this legislation will require health plans to provide reimbursement for acupuncture services for all patients and under all clinical circumstances. Insurance companies currently reject many medical procedures and treatments they consider to be without merit. The intent of this bill is to simply require that they reimburse acupuncturists. If the insured has an acupuncture service benefit in their plan and yet would otherwise have to seek that service from a medical or other provider. Others may try to also persuade you that there is no evidence of efficacy or effectiveness. This is an equally specious argument, in my view, since most plans here in Minnesota and throughout the country already provide acupuncture and do so because they've established that there is at least some value. Ironically, it wasn't long ago that allopathic medical physicians almost entirely dismissed the value of this therapy, and now it is being widely embraced. While new reimbursement models inherent in the healthcare home concept have great appeal and are gaining support, this legislation would provide acupuncturists with an additional level of recognition that they are also qualified to provide this service to patients who pay for and actually have the benefit. Last week, I attended a three-day conference in Washington at the Institute of Medicine focused on the topic of integrative medicine. Much of that conversation over 2.5 days, including a keynote presentation by Senator Tom Harkin, was about healthcare reform. In my view, at least in a small way, opposition to the legislation I speak of today seems very myopic in that context and communicates a lack of imagination and disinterest in looking at new approaches to solving a healthcare dilemma that we all agree exists. I appreciate the opportunity to share these views with you today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Bunn, you? Okay. Okay.
I'd like to call.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Green.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Michael Green. I'm a family physician, board certified in both family medicine and medical acupuncture. I've been practicing medicine, including acupuncture, for over 20 years here in the Twin Cities. I've served as an instructor and as academic dean at Edith Davis's School, the Minnesota Institute of Acupuncture and Herbal Studies. I've also been a member of the Acupuncture Advisory Council, the Board of Medical Practice, for some years, which regulates acupuncturists in the state. I'm very familiar with acupuncture and oriental medicine, the training of licensed acupuncturists, and the way acupuncture is practiced in the state. And I'd like to express my support for HF 286, which provides for parity for licensed acupuncturists. I'll try and not restate what's been said by others, but currently most health plans will pay for acupuncture treatment for some conditions like chronic pain, nausea and vomiting, when provided by a physician. Unfortunately, there are only a handful of physicians in Minnesota qualified to do acupuncture or to legitimately supervise someone else doing acupuncture, or for that matter, to review claims for possible denial of benefits. For example, there are about 10 Minnesota physicians who are board certified in medical acupuncture, and two Minnesota physicians that I know of who are also licensed acupuncturists. I know many of them, and they mostly do conventional medicine because the demands of that expand to fill all available time, and reimbursement is better for the time spent. My colleagues at the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture, which is a national physician acupuncturist organization, confirm that this pattern is national. And there's a recent study done at Harvard that showed the same thing. Basically, most physicians who have learned acupuncture don't practice it. And of those who do, most of them practice it only as a small part of what they do. So therefore, to expect that Minnesotans would be able to get all the care in terms of acupuncture treatments that might be warranted or helpful, it just simply can't happen. So the current system that we have supports really one of three models, none of which serves the citizens of Minnesota. One, the patient may be referred to a licensed acupuncturist and pays out of pocket. This costs the health plans nothing for services that they otherwise would cover. It's quite a deal. Number two, the patient is referred to an institution like the HFA Alternative Medicine Clinic in Minneapolis or Abbott Northwest Institute for Health and Healing, which has basically provides an expensive, relatively expensive evaluation by a physician who may or may not know much about acupuncture and who arranges for licensed acupuncturists employed by the institution to actually perform the service. This is much more expensive than the same care provided directly by a licensed acupuncturist. It's very limited in availability. We're not talking about easy access from outside the Twin Cities. So even though the cost for treatment is higher, the total cost for the health plans is low for services they don't have to provide. Third possibility is the patient's referred to a physician who's qualified to do acupuncture. So of the 12 or so physicians in the state, let's be generous and say that 8 of them actually do some acupuncture in their busy schedules. Typically, certainly one or two that I know have a few hours a week set aside to do acupuncture, and let's be generous and say it's a half a day. Maybe they could see 12 patients in a half a day to do acupuncture. And a patient would need to be seen several times. That's not a lot of patients. Like choice number two, the health plan's cost is low for services that are supposedly covered but simply are unavailable. I'll stop there and be available for any questions.
Okay, thank you. I think this is the last proponent witness, so if people have questions, you want to wait? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is while he's water changing hands. I just forgot one.
Ms. Coleman, yeah, go ahead.
The Health Partners already pays for this, and many other major medical insurers do. I want to give credit where it's due. So, and I just I forgot to mention that.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Coleman. I work for Medica, but today I'm representing the 8 nonprofit health plans through the Council of Health Plans. So thank you for this opportunity. I would just like to comment that I did have a brief opportunity to speak with Representative Clark a few days ago on this. And also over the summer, the Council of Health Plans did meet with some representatives from the acupuncture committee, licensed acupuncturist community, to talk about some of these issues. We did not reach an agreement, which is why we're here today, but we will continue to have those conversations. So first, I would like to just clarify a few issues, and Representative Bunn, you hit on one of them. It is true that most health plans reimburse MDs and chiropractors for a very narrow scope of acupuncture services. And these are limited to a small number of treatments where there is adequate scientific evidence documented as to the efficacy of the treatment. So there is not broad agreement that there's broad efficaciousness, but there are for science, strong scientific information for some some areas of coverage for this. And that in many instances where this is covered through the health plans, the services actually are provided by the licensed acupuncturists who have the additional training, but they're billed through a physician or chiropractor who is overseeing the overall treatment plan, which in many instances goes beyond the services being provided by the chiropractor, by the acupuncturist. So while it is accurate to say that health plans do not reimburse acupuncturists directly, it is not accurate to say that we do not reimburse services provided by a licensed acupuncturist for some treatments. We do believe that this legislation that would provide direct access to acupuncturists will add cost in a couple of ways. Many individuals right now choose to pay for these alternative therapies out of their own pocket. In addition to acupuncture, there's other therapies such as massage therapy, healing touch, herbal medicine, just to name a few of these. By mandating direct access to acupuncturists, these costs, which people are paying out of their pocket, will then be shifted onto the insurance pool. So this is where this committee has had the challenge and the difficulty over the last few years to decide what should be a part of the healthcare benefit and what shouldn't be a part of the healthcare benefit. The other costs that will be increased if this legislation passes are administrative costs. So health plans would need to credential these providers, which right now, if they're receiving services through a hospital or through a clinic, the clinic and the hospital have that responsibility of ensuring that these individuals are licensed and have the appropriate credentials. But also, the health plans would need to implement management structures and techniques to ensure that these services are not being overutilized, and that services to treat diagnoses that are not supported by the science, such as treatment for digestive disorders, addiction disorders, and others, are not being provided for in the insurance. I would also like to point out that there are some other options available for individuals who want to receive these services other than mandating insurance coverage. Many of the health plans do have discount programs available where they have it's not insurance coverage, but it's a discount available to a network of acupuncturists where our members can use that. In addition, acupuncture services are something that are eligible to be paid for with tax-free dollars through a flexible savings account or a health savings account as well through their employers. So finally, I would just like to comment on the work that was done in this legislature last session and that is going on in the community to transform both the way healthcare is delivered and how healthcare is paid for. There is near consensus that our existing system, which pays for volume and services rather than outcome and value, cannot be sustained. It is not improving outcomes, it is certainly not making for satisfied patients, and it is bankrupting us. It is bankrupting us whether we're talking about a government-run system, it is bankrupting us whether we're talking about a private-run system. And this legislation, in my opinion, looks back and not forward to a system that needs to be held accountable for improved outcomes and higher efficiency measures. If acupuncture services provide better outcomes at a lower cost and increases patient satisfaction, then hospitals and clinics would be incented to include them, as some have, as a part of their healthcare team. Creating reimbursement that further fragments care is not the direction that this committee said they wanted to go last session. So with that, I'll answer any questions that members have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, you mentioned that health savings accounts cover this, that you can use your tax deductible money in your... No. Or you can use your money in your account to pay for acupuncture services. And
Ms. Coleman.
And, well, I'm not done with the question.
I'm not sure. Well, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the question is, can you use it for any acupuncture treatment? I mean, you're trying to draw a distinction here between, you know, treatments for certain things and not others. And I guess my question is, do you know if under that program you can use the money for any treatment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I am not an IRS tax expert, but the information, the direction that is given by the IRS is that you can reimburse acupuncture services for medical services. Now, how they define medical services and where that direction comes from, I'm not sure, but it implies that it is a very broad eligibility for to use your HSA account to pay for these services.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chair, and the question I originally wanted to ask was whether, and maybe you've touched on this a little bit, but is there kind of a gatekeeper issue here that, you know, if you're saying that, you know, you're only going to reimburse physicians, that acupuncture only when it's done by physicians, and I understand you're only saying only for certain purposes also. But is that one of the concerns that if somebody can just go directly to the acupuncturist, that there's no, that the determination of need then is being made by the acupuncturist without any MD or DO imposing themselves between the, you know, making a diagnosis before you get to the treatment? Is that kind of where what you're telling us?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, you know, a piece of this is, we don't have a lot of data on acupuncture services, and so we know of a very where there is science, and there are others here that are much more experts than I am on this, but from the literature that I have read, there are certain things. We've heard that reference to chronic pain. There's some evidence there. It's not as strong as I think some would say. Certainly post-operative nausea seems to be the strongest evidence of the value of this. And so part of it, I think, is since there's such a narrow scope of where we have strong scientific evidence of this, and I understand it's growing, but it's not there yet, we don't really know if this would be a more efficient matter to directly access or not to. And so it's a little bit of a leap of faith without having information in front of us to know will this result in cost savings or not. We do know, as I mentioned, there will absolutely be additional costs for people who pay out of pocket. That will shift to the cost, and then the administrative cost that would be created. When we met last August with some of the with the proponents of this bill, we had asked them, if you have data, if you have studies that show this saves money, and bring that to us, we would love to see that. They did provide us some information around the efficaciousness of this use in some areas, but not to show that it saves money. We have not seen that.
If you, in terms of restricting the types of the evidence base, can't you do that already? Do you do that with your doctors and DOs right now?
We do limit the coverage of this to very narrow. And again,
so how would this change that then?
Mr. Chair, as I had testified, what happens is that people who are currently paying out of pocket, that would get shifted into that, but we'd have to create mechanisms and structures to provide the credentialing, to provide the oversight, to ensure that it's being billed appropriately, that services are not maintenance services aren't being paid for. There's a number of administrative costs that would go into doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could comment a couple things, and later also the other advocates. First of all, the issue of the access issue and the gatekeeper.
And we have about 6 minutes left in this bill.
Okay, and the gatekeeper issue. The Aetna and Cigna documentation on kind of their clinical guidelines for acupuncture, they list 6 to 8 areas, or 8 to 10 areas maybe, where they approve of acupuncture services as medically necessary based on their extensive literature reviews, and they believe these areas are medically founded in terms of the evidence. And they include things, I'm going to read just one of the two, is nausea and vomiting with pregnancy, nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy, post-operative nausea and vomiting, post-operative dental pain, and the following painful conditions, headache, low back pain, neck pain, and knee pain. It struck me in looking at this list that there are many, many possible causes for medically related causes for these things, and that one of the issues I would think, and this is not to undervalue acupuncture because it's been around forever and there may be very valid stuff that we just don't have a good enough research on yet. I would think that because these have many, many sources and that they are related to conditions like pregnancy, chemotherapy, and dental, that one would actually possibly want them to have seen a different type of primary practitioner, medical practitioner, before seeing an acupuncturist. So that's one part of it, is that part of what's going on with insurance plans. And the second part is, why don't we have in this area, this is to both the author and Ms. Coleman, why don't we have a system here whereby, in addition to possibly having licensed acupuncturists who are working in conjunction with hospitals, clinics, doctors and chiropractors, as it appears we do now, that we allow physicians to prescribe, just like they used to do for PT, this service. Partly it's a lack of knowledge about physicians to do that, and so we need to educate them better and have in our medical school training have exposure to that. But why wouldn't that be a system to deal with this?
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn, I guess I'm not sure whether that has been looked at or what the impact of that would be. I think, again, your first comment that you made is, you know, acupuncturists treat something. They don't diagnose what it is that's being treated. And so there is that desire to have the physician involved. And again, in these things we pay for, it's part of a treatment plan. So, again, I think, you know, with a referral, and I think, and I want to say, there are differences in how plans treat this. There is a plan in the community that will, with the diagnosis, and then have a number of visits that will be covered. So that is something that some payers in the community have looked at doing. It's just not been taken up by all of them.
President Clark?
I think it might be helpful to ask one of the other witnesses to come back to just help clarify again which health plans provide this and which don't. And I just want to clarify, so if we could do that, I think it would be helpful to have that information just on the table again. And I do want to say we are not expanding.
I don't know if there's other questions, but Representative Bunn asked both of you the questions, so that's why. Ms. Coleman to stay. So. Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative Clark.
This isn't for all of us at this table. I guess I just want to be really clear that we are not creating a new mandate for an insurance company that doesn't want to cover acupuncture to all of a sudden add that. We need to say that over and over. What we're talking about is if already acupuncture is part of what is the benefit of that plan, then we're talking about equal access to highly qualified practitioners, highly trained, master's degree trained, equal to master's degree trained professionals, rather than limiting it to someone who may have taken a weekend course, you know, and have an MD behind their name. There are, some of our physicians here are expert and are licensed acupuncturists, but many of them aren't, I know programs are being offered. So I think it would be helpful, again, just to go over, as I was saying, what the health plans do already offer this, and then it might make it clearer, again, to people that what we're talking about is, you know, having highly qualified people be part of what the consumer's right is. And I don't know how to say any more clearer than that, but you can look on line 1.25 on the first page and line 2.31 on the second page that states very clearly, I mean, we made sure this is in the bill, that we are not changing or adding benefits to existing policies or contracts.
Any other questions for Ms. Holmer? Thank you. Sorry to keep you here. Mr. Hickey? Just add if there's new stuff, if we could, so we can move on. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We had quite a discussion about mandates and how few people they're reaching and how much the market in this state has changed since people started doing this back in the 1970s a couple weeks ago, so I'm not going to be totally redundant. But we're very concerned about yet another mandate here. As you know, I represent the largest business group in terms of entities with 13,500 approximately across this state, and we are clearly the most affected constituency of mandates, since virtually none of our members have taken the risk and gotten in the endeavor of trying to self-insure. And so, you know, this is, I hope the last one we see this year. Acupuncture is certainly a viable and worthwhile treatment for people. Our concern is this inequitable market situation we have, and the fact that about 73% of the commercial market, according to the last, the private market, according to the last analysis by the Minnesota Department of Health, is not in the state market. 23% is. So you're 27% is, 73% is not. And so you're reaching virtually nobody. And they're not nobody, but you're reaching very few people. And they started back in the 1970s, maybe they had 90%, 95% in the state market, and that's just dwindled down and down every year. And when the analysis came out, and as we discussed a couple weeks ago, at the hearing on autism, it was really shocking to see the health department, with the best analysis we have to date, right now saying 27% are affected, and I think that alone is enough to give everybody pause. What are we doing? We're putting these mandates or new coverages, however we want to define this, or new requirements, however we want to define this, on the people who have the least ability to pay, small businesses and individuals. And before mandate, we go forward with anything else around here, I would hope members of this committee would insist on some kind of a review. We really need a mandatory review process. And every time we bring a mandate forward here, it really shows why we need it. But I would hope you would insist on some kind of a rudimentary review that would at least try to get at cost and usage. Because for this legislature to ask on these and not act on these and not know cost and not know usage is really concerning. And, you know, the vast majority of people will not benefit from this. And this is really a concerning trend this year. And I don't want to be redundant from what I said last time. So I just want to urge you not to advance this bill. And thanks for the chance to speak before you.
Thank you. Last remarks,
Mr. Clark? I don't know if people need to hear again. I was offering just to have a review of what the health plans do offer, but I would just ask again, what we're talking about here is consumers' right to have access to highly trained professionals who are already licensed, practice independently in the state of Minnesota. We're not putting any new mandate on any insurance company, just making sure, again, that there's equal access to these professionals. So I would urge the committee to support the bill.
All right. You haven't had all your questions answered, huh, Representative Bunn? You can ask another one if you want.
Mr. Chair, I think others did, too. I just can't imagine voting on this without much, much further discussion. So I'm concerned about the time frame we've evidently set up for this.
So, go ask away.
Well, just offer the... one concern I have is on the Aetna information that I received on their guidelines for clinical policy related to acupuncture. It lists eight clinical areas for which they cover acupuncture through their current system of non-direct access physicians. And this is not quite a question about direct access or not, but they list almost 50 areas where acupuncture has been used or is sometimes used that they don't cover, including different types of pain conditions, some of which they don't cover, although chronic low back pain is one of the things they do cover it for. My concern here is when we have the direct access, and we don't have time really to talk about why I think it is. This will play a major role in healthcare reform, and I very much value alternative therapies. I use them myself for chronic pain. But in this case, we now have direct access here, it would be difficult to monitor, I think, in this system, whether or not, if it was just going to use exactly the same criteria, for example, in Aetna, whether or not these many new providers who are now brought into the system directly are, in fact, limiting their services to the eight currently covered benefits versus things on the other list of possible 50 areas they might serve generally in their practice. So I think that there is a monitoring and challenge for the healthcare plans to not make this expansive benefit. And frankly, I'm concerned that one of the unanticipated and consequences of this legislation is the health plans that currently cover it may stop covering it because of this legislation. So I'm concerned about a number of unintended consequences, one of them being cost to this legislation, but also I'm concerned they may stop covering this service generally.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't worry too much about that. I think there might be actually increased coverage because of the efficacy by people who are highly trained. But I would point out again, what the lines 1.25, 1.26 on the front page and the other lines point out is that we're not adding to the benefit. So if the contract says that acupuncture is available for XYZ, then XYZ is what's covered, not LMNOP. You know, I mean, it's what's already in the contract. So that's my understanding of what we're trying to do here. We're trying to make sure, again, that people have equal access to highly trained professionals, not to expand the coverage.
Just
very, very brief. I just to help people know what you're talking about, what you're not talking about, I can do it with a one-minute version here. Just reading the scope of practice from what we've licensed them to do. They're primary care. They do diagnose according to Oriental methods. So they also are required to refer out for a list of things that they're concerned about that are unexplained. And Representative Clark mentioned that it doesn't add any new benefit. But I
when you use these kinds of things, people quit using medication. They quit. They get healthy. We pay indefinitely for hypertensive drugs. Mm-hmm. It's not a mandate, but it's in the business of what we do. We pay forever for diabetic stuff, which is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And some of these people, when they go, don't need some of that stuff and other things like that. And the plans that use it well save money. Mm-hmm. And that's my short thing. That's why I've got a lifetime watching this stuff work, and it's remarkable. They come last to these practitioners most commonly, mm-hmm. as a last resort. I'm like, well, I'm better now. It's mm-hmm. you could have 100 testimonies if they would have mm-hmm. had time.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. I'll keep my comments brief. Even if this isn't described as a mandated benefit, we talk all the time about creating basic health care and that we ought to assure people access to basic health care as a way of saving costs and providing access. And as we add more and more requirements in state law, whether they're seen as mandates or not, we're adding to the basic cost, and it keeps going up and up and up. I don't know that this bill increases or decreases access to an acupuncturist if I wanted one right now. I understand what Representative Clark is saying about improving the professionalism and access to professional providers there, but I do get concerned about us piling on, and I think that this has the potential for increasing healthcare costs rather than decreasing them at a time when we need to make it more affordable.
Any other questions? Representative Clark, anything you want to add now?
No, I just appreciate the support of the committee.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, I'll renew my motion that House File 286 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman of Lofter.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move that House File 705 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee.
All right. That motion is before us. See your bill. Representative Lofter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Almost everyone knows someone who died too young from a disease that could have been successfully caught early and overcome if it had been screened at an earlier stage in advancement. Cancer and heart disease are often the focus of this, but there are others as well. This bill is about saving lives while helping control health care costs. It ensures that people with a high deductible health plan with a health savings account will not only get a federal and state tax advantage, but they also have access to life-saving preventative care and early diagnostic tests. It does not limit the sale of high deductible health plans without preventative care. They just would not qualify for the tax advantage health savings account. And I have found in talking to people about this bill that there's a lot of confusion about what these plans are and how they work. So I'm just going to do a little brief health insurance 101. High deductible health plans are those in which you pay not only your monthly premiums, but then you also pay a deductible up to a certain amount before any insurance coverage kicks in. And there's a wide variety of them. The provisions in federal law that allow someone covered by one of these high deductible health plans to also have a tax advantage health savings account says that they must have a minimum annual deductible beyond premiums of $1,150 for an individual, with that individual having a $5,800 per year maximum total out-of-pocket cost. For a family, the minimum deductible is $2,300. So in addition to paying their premiums, they would pay the first $2,300 of services, and there would be a maximum of $11,600 in out-of-pocket costs per year. So you can see why it's important for someone who gets one of these products to want to save and have access to resources to pay for that. There's no requirement that employers pay into a health savings account or provide any kind of coverage for those deductible accounts, but many employers do, not all do. Many people take this because of price sensitivity, and they do not have the wherewithal financially to contribute anything towards that. And I think we've heard about that from some of the hospitals and some of the issues they've run into. I think the high deductible health plans are an appropriate product and work for a lot of people.
particularly when they're matched with an employer contribution, and it's people who have the ability to work with it. This bill implements a federal option. It's the only option that the federal government has made available related to health savings accounts, and that is that if you are to, a state chooses, it may require preventative coverage in the high deductible health plan in order for the covered person to establish a tax advantage health savings account. Health savings accounts are a special dedicated savings account that has the advantage of being tax-free going in and tax-free going out as it, when it's used for health services. And so it's a nice advantage. But this bill is really focused on who should get that tax advantage. The estimate is that in 2011, state taxpayers will be subsidizing health savings accounts in terms of a tax expenditure about $9 million. And this is just to make sure that they're getting good value for that tax subsidy and that we're incentivizing life-saving preventative coverage. Preventative care is defined in the federal regulations. It's routine care that's been well-documented to prevent costly health problems or treat treatable diseases early while treatment options are more affordable and successful. It includes vaccination, blood pressure tests, blood tests, diabetes, cholesterol testing, cancer screening such as mammograms, pap smears, well-child checkups, etc. And the bill provides that the health plan or the health insurer offering this would, by reference, an evidence-based set of preventative care guidelines and would also indicate scope and frequency of by which someone would be eligible. So you couldn't have a worried well person who wanted a mammogram, say, every 3 months. It would be according to an evidence-based standard selected by the health plan. There's been questions raised about whether this would limit market choice, and our Commerce Department reviews 1,200 insurance plans a year. You cannot offer an insurance plan in Minnesota without the permission of the Commerce Department, and they vary widely on some may have higher co-pays, some will have more deductibles, some will be an 80-20 plan, some might be 75-25. There's plenty of choice in the market. I think the choice before us today is whether or not we want a tax advantage combination of high deductible and health savings plan to also cover preventive at the same time. The American Cancer Society has demonstrated with a lot of statistics how cost-effective prevention is, both for the person who's impacted as well as for the insurance company. Colorectal cancer can be treated more than 90% of the time if detected early. Screening via a colonoscopy every 10 years after age 50 costs about 55 cents per member per month. Detecting and removing a precancerous polyp is about $1,100 as compared to $58,000 if the polyp goes undetected and goes to stage 4. Treating precancerous cervical lesions and found with a pap test costs between $1,000 and $2,000. But if it's not detected early and becomes cancer, it can cost as much as $33,000 to treat. So it's in the interest of the insurance company very often to promote prevention and to make it cost effective. While only 1% of the commercially insured population has cancer, it costs about 10% of an employer and insurer's annual medical claims. Clearly, prevention and early diagnosis pays for all involved. The cost of prevention is generally fairly modest. There's a 2002 study that said the cost of recommended cancer screenings when averaged over an insured population is about $7.25 per member per month. A small investment in saving lives, I would assume that has at least doubled since then, which could be about $240 a year. You can easily adjust for that by changing the amount of copay that someone has to pay for an ambulance ride or a deductible or copay on prescriptions or other provisions in a policy. And I think it's important to note, too, that as we try and deal with healthcare cost containment, 25% of people who are insured change plans every year. And those who are paying for, as employers or as individuals, for fully insured plans end up absorbing the cost of people who switch from not getting their preventative care
and go on to another plan and then incur major expenses. I'm committed to pursuing many creative approaches to making health care coverage affordable and accessible to all, but having people die early from health conditions that could have been caught earlier and treated successfully is not the way we should be approaching lower health care costs. I trust the creativity of our insurance market to come up with products that both meet a price point that people want, which is why they're selecting this product, as well as fully covering the preventative care that we all rely on in order to save lives. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to respond to questions.
Thank you. Mr. Aaron. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Ahrens, Director of Government Relations for the American Cancer Society in Minnesota. March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month, so we're talking about the right topic already. And I'm very pleased to be able to share our views on this bill that would help make sure more Minnesotans receive recommended colon cancer screenings. Before I go any further, I must, it's my due diligence to ask you if you know anyone who's 50 or over or at high risk of colon cancer, please urge them to go get screened. So there's the commercial. The number of underinsured is growing in America. We talk about uninsured people a lot in our debate, but the underinsured population is growing, and that's what this bill is focused on. According to the Commonwealth Fund, a reputable think tank in this area, adults with chronic diseases, half of the underinsured and more than 60% of the uninsured skip medications for their conditions because of cost. Both groups were at higher risk of going to the emergency room or hospital than chronically ill adults who were insured all year or not underinsured. According to the same source from 2003-2007, the number of adults who were insured all year but were underinsured increased 60%. Based on those who incur high out-of-pocket costs relative to their income, not counting premiums, despite having coverage all year, an estimated 25 million adults under the age 65 were underinsured in 2007. It's a big, big part of our population. Efforts to empower consumers of healthcare and make private healthcare should not create perverse trade-offs between the principles of affordability and adequacy of healthcare coverage. HSAs are an attempt to empower consumers, and there's nothing wrong with that. But trading off affordability and adequacy is really a false choice for consumers. Health insurance, public or private, that does not pay for proven chronic disease prevention and detection services is inadequate, and the inadequacy can and may result in cancer that could have been detected and higher than necessary treatment costs. Prevention has been the cornerstone of the American Cancer Society's policy, research, and programs. We cannot reduce cancer incidence and mortality without a strong and sustained societal investment in prevention. Based on what is known today about cancer prevention, detection, as many as 60% of cancer deaths could be avoided each year. Now, I wanted to just stop there and share a little bit. Representative Loeffler mentioned some of the costs of cancer treatment. I wanted to share a little bit more on that in an updated way, because it gets worse. Treating a precancerous cervical lesion found with a pap test before it becomes cancer costs between $1,000 and $2,000. But if that same lesion is not detected early and becomes cancerous, it can cost as much as $33,000 to treat. An average mammogram costs about $125. In comparison, one study found that a stage 1 breast cancer costs an estimated $22,000 to treat, while a stage 4 breast cancer costs an estimated $57,000. Now, on colon cancer, a precancerous polyp can be removed for about $1,500, and that's what Representative Loeffler mentioned. But the latest Medicare reimbursement rate costs for distant stage colorectal cancer, if not screened early, can rise up to around $200,000. So screening saves a lot of money. There's a real concern that many individuals enrolled in consumer-directed healthcare plans may choose to forgo prevention and early detection services to reduce their healthcare expenditures. When faced with exhausting their employee-sponsored health spending account or doing without cancer screenings or other prevention early detection services, out of pocket. Many enrollees may choose the latter. Limitations on covered benefits, including high out-of-pocket costs, impede one's ability to benefit from early detection of or screening for cancer. Studies have found that cost-sharing alone significantly contributes to low utilization of preventive care. Access to prevention and early detection services and incentives to provide their use must be maintained and encouraged. Without incentives for prevention and early detection services, many employees enrolled in consumer-directed health plans may not seek out such services when weighing how to spend finite funds. American Cancer Society supports this legislation to ensure that consumer-directed healthcare plans are required to include preventative services as a standard benefit, and we don't grow the total number of underinsured, and we are still remaining on our goals to make sure that more and more Minnesotans have adequate, affordable, and available healthcare insurance. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Renner.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dave Renner. I represent the Minnesota Medical Association. The MMA represents over 10,000 physicians, medical students, medical residents throughout the state. As hopefully many of you know, we've been engaged in the issues of trying to address access and affordability for many years. Going back to 2005 with our physicians plan for Healthy Minnesota, in 2006 forming the Healthy Minnesota Partnership for Reform, which included 26 stakeholders involved in these important issues. From this work, we've kind of developed a vision for the system in which all Minnesotans have affordable coverage for essential benefits that allow them to get the needed care and preventive services in a timely and effective manner. We believe this is best accomplished through market-based reforms, and we also believe that HSAs, health savings accounts, are one of those options that should be included in those reforms. But a lot of our discussion in those work network did also focus on the preventive care, and you've heard a lot of the discussion from Cancer Society and from Representative Loftus. I won't go into all those numbers, but very clearly the reforms that you all passed last year also focused significantly on prevention. And reforms dealing with healthcare homes and chronic disease management. I think that the policy debate that you all struggle with, or need to debate, is not whether we should allow, this bill doesn't say whether we should allow first dollar coverage in all cases with high deductibles. As Representative Loeffler pointed out, this is talking about if an entity or a person wants to receive the tax advantages of a health savings account or a medical savings account, then we would argue that we need to make sure that we ensure appropriate financial incentives in those products. If we're going to provide that tax advantage, then we think that the state does have a legitimate role of saying we think the incentives need to be in the right way, especially in the area of preventive care, which, as you know, has been shown to save money. So for those reasons, the MMA does support the House File 705. Again, we would argue, as Representative Loeffler pointed out, this does not prohibit a high deductible plan being offered that has cost sharing for preventive services. It just says that if we're going to provide a tax incentive and a tax advantage to government tax advantage, then in those cases we think that first dollar coverage should be provided for preventive services. With that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hickey here. Okay. And Mr. Griffin, I like your thinking to come together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. We'll pull on. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing the Minnesota Council of Health Plans today, and we're here to oppose House File 705. We appreciate the opportunity that we've had with Representative Loeffler to discuss this legislation both last session and in recent days. Mr. Chairman, members, House File 705 would increase the cost of health coverage products typically purchased by most price-sensitive consumers. This would be a large expansion of preventive services currently considered appropriate in Minnesota and increase the cost of products in two ways. First, the expansion of covered services at no cost to the individual would increase the cost of care covered by the plan and thereby increase the premium. And you've heard from the previous witnesses that there is this concern about whether people can afford coverage, whether they will be able to deal with those preventive services that they think in this bill are necessary. I would also put before you the other idea, which is if you can't afford any insurance at all, if you are increasing the cost of that insurance, which we think this bill will do, that makes it unaffordable for people to buy coverage, period. Mr. Chairman, the second way in which this increases is because the federal tax definition prohibits any service that is intended to treat an existing illness, injury, or condition from being preventive. Every claim other than those certain screening services would require determination if the care was to treat an existing condition. This would substantially increase the administrative cost of such a plan and thereby increase the premium. This bill would affect all high-deductible health plans. The expansion would not affect only individual products, but those in small and large groups as well. Employers who are unable to cover the costs of certain group plans rely on reduced premium costs of high-deductible health plans. Increasing the cost of these plans to cover all preventative services could cause employers to drop coverage. It limits choice in the individual market. And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is the part of the bill that I find the most objectionable. I can go out and buy my own policy, which I have done as an individual. I'm smart enough to know to get my preventive services. I went and got my colonoscopy when I needed it. I chose to make a decision that I would rather purchase a high-deductible policy, keep that money in my HSA, and use it as I thought was fit rather than having the state dictate it to me. If we're going to have a debate on what the real preventive services are, then we should have that debate, and we should bring everyone in to talk about those services, but not do it through this mechanism. Last but not least, members, we think that this would complicate policies. It would be difficult, if not impossible, to describe the details of the services covered as preventative and certificate of coverage. In addition, the tax limitations on services which might be preventive in one circumstance would not necessarily be so in another circumstance. It may be impossible to adequately describe which services are preventive. Mr. Chairman, members, those are the comments that we have. If there are questions, I'd be happy to take them. I know Mr. Hickman wants to speak as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Do you have policies right now that cover preventive services?
Yes, we do, Mr. Chairman.
And is that what percentage of the market of HSA is covered for preventive services?
Mr. Chairman, I can't speak for all of the plans, but I can speak to you about what's going on at Preferred One in particular, and I mentioned this to Representative Loeffler when we were discussing it. Since Preferred One received its HMO license, CISM license at that time, which has since been converted, which is just a little over 10 years ago, all of our policies at that time, with the exception of a very small percentage, less than 10%, were in the low deductible area. Today we've more than moved to 10 times that, about 50,000 lives, and 90% of our policies are high deductible these days.
I was more asking how many cover preventive services.
How many cover preventive services?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's one of the things that we've been working on in this bill. We would suggest to you that all of ours cover preventive services.
And how do you
the question
define
is,
that?
How do we define that?
Yeah, your whole argument was about the difficulty of defining preventive services. But
Mr. Chairman, and maybe I wasn't very clear in trying to specify that. The problem in trying to define the preventive services is this bill sets them out.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, as this bill sets them out, this expands them into this area where you're trying to differentiate between those services that are actually preventive and not part of the pre-existing condition and treatment that was going onward versus the others. And we have a listing of certain procedures and codes that are put into policies these days, and those are the ones that we define in our policy currently.
All right. Representative Ruth.
I just have a comment. There was a great article in last week's paper in the business section about LifeSource. LifeSource, which is a very, it's a gem of a company here in Minnesota, and they do have high deductible. They have health savings accounts, but they also have, they cover preventative services, and they also have an education piece. So I know, Mr. Griffin, you mentioned that you went out and got your colonoscopy, which is great. I'm glad to hear that. But
and
not everybody has that, you know, I think, understands the importance of that. And it's the high deductibles have played a bigger and bigger role, as has been pointed out. And the health savings account, when they're used in conjunction, I mean, we are seeing problems, and the hospitals will testify to that, I think. And I think, Representative Walker, I just want to thank you for your bill, because I think it highlights the importance of us, the decisions that we have to make, where we're putting our tax dollars, and we are giving, when we are giving a tax benefit, that's taxpayer dollars. So we have to be thoughtful about that, and there's a right way to go about it, and you know, there's better ways, and I think Representative Walker has a great bill.
Mr.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Back again, just wanted to make some brief comments. My group at the federal level and the state level strongly supported the enactment of HSAs as a way to innovate, as a way to provide more options to people, as a way to provide more choices. And they haven't been in place that long, and I think they're working pretty well for the vast majority of people. The concern here is this appears to be restricting that choice. Or is restricting that choice, and some people are going to want to just pursue the lowest possible premium. We have a lot of price-sensitive customers. I used to think of them as young people who don't have insurance. I think in this economy, anybody can be price-sensitive. You could find a person in advanced middle age looking for every possible option to save costs for themselves and their employees. But so traditionally thought of it as young people. And try to bring in the quote invincible young people and try to get them to get insurance to some degree to cover the typical calamities that are about the only thing they need to worry about. Well, the concern here is that we're restricting the choices, and we need to provide as many choices for price sensitive people. Regarding your question, Mr. Chairman, this is going back to discussions we had in 07 when last time I was involved in a hearing on this. I remember a lot of the plans. Back then, offering some preventive care with HSAs, making Minnesota somewhat unique. And I don't know if that's still the case, and maybe there'll be some testimony later to verify that. But I remember recalling that from 07. If that's the case, Minnesota is ahead of the game, and that we're providing some basic preventive care. Maybe it's just enough for a physical, but that's the screen for a lot of problems people have. And so if that is still the case, or if that was true, then Minnesota definitely has a superior HSA plan. But I think overall, we don't want to see this bill passed. We want to provide as much option for people as possible. And, it's great to have total coverage. And I think the point was made earlier that we all know somebody who suffered some terrible disease and dealt with it. That has happened to people who had first dollar coverage. That has happened to people who had significant coverage, but you still have to have the will to want to go see a doctor, to be tested, to take the time out of your day, take the time out of your work life to go do that. And so, I don't think we can make the assumption that if you have an HSA, you're going to miss all this and possibly run more risk than somebody else who has just the opposite policy, that has significant coverage, but they have to have the will to go see doctors and be tested and take time out of their life. And so, in the final analysis, we tell you not to pass this bill and provide as much choice for people as you can, especially those who are very sensitive to price. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. My recollection of 07 was that there was a concern about defining preventive care, and I think the health plans came up with the idea of referring to the IRS. So I'm a little confused now about the criticism of that definition. But I don't know if you have any. Is that right, Representative Locke? Is that what I remember
Mr.
correctly?
Mr. Chairman, that would not be my recollection. Okay. We believe that the definition of the federal law is pretty expansive. And,
okay. Anyway, that's just because that reference to 07 came up. There's some other testimony, but if you want to comment on that, Representative Locke. While Mr. Hesse and Ms. Brace.
The original bill draft just referred to the federal guidelines, and we added all of the language about an evidence-based standard, frequency and scope, defining what the coverage would be for high-risk individuals versus people who are asymptomatic, in many large group meetings of health plan representatives, and it actually is their language that was added to the bill to make sure that people couldn't abuse this, that it really had to be an evidence-based recommendation.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber also opposes this legislation, basically just for two reasons, price and choice. We believe the legislation will increase the price of HSA products to our members. Adding preventative coverage, all of the things being equal, is new amounts of spending, health spending that go from the deductible portion into the coverage portion, the premium portion. So that certainly will increase members' costs. The HSAs have been a real popular choice for small businesses generally, and certainly a lot of our members. They do that because, as Mr. Hickey said, they're very price sensitive, and any increase in price has the potential to have some companies fall off those that are offering coverage. Finally, we also believe that this will effectively take away one option for companies to purchase coverage, and that is policies that do not cover preventative care. We think it will take that option away, because without the federal or state tax advantage, it really will price that out of the marketplace. Again, employers that purchase HSA products are very price sensitive, and without that tax advantage, I just don't think that's a very viable option for most employers. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, members? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Brace, and then I skipped over Ms. Cotman, so you can make your way down. I apologize for that. It was a paid transition, so go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Brace. I'm president of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And our concern about this bill is that, the HSA was created to give a low-cost option for people to essentially have true catastrophic coverage, so that they would be covered for things that were financially catastrophic events or for things that were high cost chronic conditions. And so every time you add a mandate to a policy, you increase the cost, and this would essentially be a mandate on HSAs. And essentially taking out the HSA out of the HSA, because that's the whole idea of an HSA, is that you use your money as you wish, and you can even negotiate prices for that initial money. But when you actually force people to pay for something right from the get-go, it's not really a good HSA anymore. However, individuals can choose to buy HSAs with preventive care, but they should have the choice of doing it with or doing it without, because it is, after all, their money, and now, particularly now, they're all thinking about every last dollar, if not every last dime. So, I'd also say that this is essentially, for an HSA, even though we're talking about taxes here, and we're talking about, they get a tax benefit, it's imposing a healthcare tax on them, because they're not going to have a choice now to find an HSA at a lower cost, because now they would have to pay for this additional service. And the last thing I'm going to say, because I thought it was very good, and I just want to read it into the record, it comes from Mike Hausman. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he comes from Dallas, Minnesota, and Dassel, Minnesota, and he sent this testimony to you, and I was reading it, and I thought, well, this is very good. And he says, while I appreciate Representative Loeffler's concern...
It's already in the record.
Is it in the record? But it's not actually in the record for anybody who is listening. So let me just say the one comment I wanted to... He says that my family has chosen our own personal road regarding freedom and responsibility for our health, and I would like it to stay that way. So I think that has to do with the individuals wanting to make choices and have the full amount of products available in order to make choices for what worked for them, for their money, and for their health. Thank you.
Representative Ruth.
Well, I just want to clarify. I think there may be some confusion. High deductible plans are different than HSAs. They're two different things, and I think it was a little confusing in your testimony, so to clarify that, and to reflect back to my earlier comments about LifeSource, the other thing I think that they do well is they have the HSAs, and as an employer, they pay into the HSA to add to that, and those dollars are pre-tax dollars, and those are dollars that can be used to pay for their medical care. So it is, they're totally separate than a high deductible. High deductible is a plan, the HSA is more of a tax benefit.
However, Mr. Chair, an HSA requires a high deductible plan to go with it. So it is a high deductible plan, but it is a different way that it functions. And so there's no reason why an individual couldn't choose an HSA with preventive care if that's what they want, pay extra, or do it without. That should be their choice.
Thank you. Ms. Cotman. And to the extent we can focus on new information, that would be great. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Forgive my lack of knowledge on protocol. I came here thinking that I would be a little bit of an add-on. Let me identify myself. I'm a small business owner. I'm a former economics student with that degree, Spanish minor, just to throw it in. And the healthcare has been a pet project of mine for many years, and I have a high deductible HSA at my place of employment. And I made that offer for very good reasons. Now, let's not reiterate what we've been, because that's my number one complaint with this bill. So I think I'm going to go to my conclusion first, if that's all right, Mr. Chairman.
That's wonderful.
Here are the key reasons. Oh, and I have some information for you, too. I have Health Partners, Medica, and Blue Cross Blue Shield HSA plans right there with preventive care coverage.
If you just
and
their to the page, we can
certainly
include that. Thank you.
And the second page is the Blue Cross Blue Shield update as of April this year.
Thank you.
Here are the key reasons I oppose this bill. And I think after hearing all of this, I can eliminate it, too. We already have plans and premiums that are tax-deductible to both the employer and the employee, either tax-deductible or pre-tax, which allow for 100% preventive care coverage. What I don't understand is why we are spending taxpayer dollars to reiterate that. And here is my other thing. That I did read the language in the bill, and it does very much sound like that there will, if there isn't a mandate now, there will be one. And as you can see with these pieces in front of you, right now they all have max. They have caps. They have the maximum amount covered of preventive care per patient per year. And there's a reason for that. As all the insurance people here can tell you, there's actuarial data which tells you that unlimited coverage leads to hugely high costs. So what I'm trying to figure out is, does this bill eliminate the patient's option to choose whether or not they want this higher cost program? In other words, does it force 100% preventative care coverage? If it doesn't, fine. If it does, I'm opposed to it. I'm actually still opposed to it because we don't need it. We already, I put in pre-tax. I do supplement the employees. There's a POP plan, which is 60% me, 40% them. I even help them with the transition. Why are we bothering with this to further complicate an already very, very messy issue? And maybe what started out to be protect your rights, and I don't want to go to universal health care and all of that after listening to this. I just think I want to say stop the madness. This is ridiculous. We don't need this. And if all the other things about the mandates are true about it, all the better. Let's stop creating issues where there aren't. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Thank you for coming down. Dr. Good. And again, if we could focus on stuff that hasn't already been testified about.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Robert Geist. I've been retired for about 10 or 12 years, 12 years, I guess, exactly. And I represent no one but myself, but I do talk a lot to my colleagues. So sort of represent a few of their opinions. I'm here to speak against the amendment, but I'm certainly for the spirit of it. There's no question that preventive care is high on my list, and I think on everyone's list. But if there's a mandate to insurance pay, that insurance pay for a mandate, and as I say, that's not a bad idea. Let me give you the percentage. It's 86% of all high deductible health plans, HSAs, already pay for these preventive services out of the high deductible part of the plan. So you were looking for that percentage. That's it. That's the national basis. I don't know the Minnesota basis. I think if the goal of the preventive interventions is to reduce system costs, then I'm going to quote to you Professor Louise Russell, who's the professor of economics at Rutgers and then professor of their Institute of Medicine. And she says that the goal of preventive is to reduce system costs, but the vast majority of these interventions do not do that. And more often, they increase the cost. It's all the things said by the American Cancer Society people are absolutely correct. If you personally have a cancer to cause and it gets loose, you are in trouble, and it costs enormous amounts of money. But if you do a colonoscopy on everybody, The cost of the system, at least, is probably most likely in excess of the cost of an individual running into trouble. Nonetheless, prevention care is good, and I'm not against it. So with that, I'm going to stop because everybody else has said what I was going to say. That, you know, if you get a young company with the average age 30 and there's 12 or 13 of them there and they just don't need colonoscopies and mammograms and stuff, and they shouldn't probably want to pay for that. And it certainly does drive up the cost. But I think that would sum up what I have to say. The spirit of the movement is good, but in practical terms, it's another mandate, and I think that it's unnecessary when 86% of policies already cover such prevention. Thank you very much, Dr. Chair.
Any questions? Okay. Representative Loeffler. Oh, Representative Gottwald has a question.
Thanks to the bill, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, Representative Loeffler, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I'll keep my comments brief. I originally, when I saw you say on a bill from the other side of the aisle, I was thrilled. Here's some common ground. I think Representative Rood referred to a newspaper article that you should all check out. It's actually an approach we might want to explore together for providing coverage to more people. That having been said, we heard in testimony may choose to forego, may not seek out. We're always very concerned about saving us from ourselves. And I'm trying to figure out why the state feels the need to do that. Now, I chaired the Public Health Working Group, co-chaired the Public Health Working Group, the Healthcare Access Commission, and I'm very much on board with public health. Great. We want to do preventive care. We want to prevent things up front. But the assumption that we go to the next step and in the state insists that you do it when in fact you can figure it out for yourself sometimes puzzles me. The great thing about HSAs, part of the reason they work, is they allow for flexibility. It allows for people to understand. We can educate, we can inform, we can encourage, and even partner with people to help them understand the need for preventive care at the right time, in the right way. But we do not have to, as a state, constantly mandate everything about health care. It's not necessary. The necessary flexibility is already there in the market. HSAs are wildly popular. Employers are using them more and more to provide good coverage at an affordable cost. And we know that cost is a function of access. You can't afford it, you can't get it. So as we add cost in our attempt to save us from ourselves, we're also impacting access. So I'm all on board with preventive health care, public health, but we've got to think in terms of not mandating people to do stuff that they're already able to do for themselves. I want to end with Representative Loeffler, a quote from her. She said, "I trust the creativity of our insurance market." I do too. Let's not do this.
Mr. Chairman, might I respond?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, members, and Representative Gottwald. I think there's been a lot of confusion, and once again, we're swirling around to this is not a mandate. It does not mandate preventative coverage in high deductible plans. It does require full preventative coverage without copays or deductibles if you want to take advantage of an ability to set aside a special savings account. Every high deductible product that is currently in the market will continue to be able to be licensed by the Department of Commerce for sale in Minnesota. It will not take away those choices. It will simply say we will not give a tax advantage to programs that don't have it. And I would like to use Ms. Cotman's handout as a way to explain what I mean by the creativity in the market. You will note that there are three plans here. This is for an individual age 40, a non-smoker. Health Partners, Medica, and Blue Cross Blue Shield. They vary across the top in the amount of their individual deductible. We'll just look at the individual deductible. It's kind of surprising, but Blue Cross Blue Shield, with the lowest deductible, has the lowest price. And yet, so it could, if it added another $200-$300 even into the total premium to fully cover prevention, it could be competitive with the other products. If you look under the preventative care, it's 100% up to $200 maximum per year or $300 maximum per year. None of those would cover the cost of a single colonoscopy. None of them would cover a preventative care visit and a mammogram. None of them offer much hope other than a flu vaccine and maybe going in and getting a blood pressure check or a diabetes check. And so there, I believe that you could add full preventative coverage to these policies, and you could do things like go down the line where it says deductible in-network. That number could change. You could put an urgent care visit. My policy has that I have to pay $10 for every urgent care visit. They could. There's so many moving pieces that I believe that they could find a cost-effective choice that meets this and still have it available to people who are very price-sensitive.
President Gottlieb. Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, you've proven my point. I mean, the creativity of the market is already addressing this, but your point earlier, if you understand high deductibles and HSAs in combination, it is that tax-preferred account that makes this thing great. People can take this money and do with it as they choose. They can buy their preventive care if it's not covered in the high deductible plan. And when you add this as a requirement, you do increase the cost, and it is a mandate. It isn't. You're right about the high deductible portion, but these two things work in concert. And it is that flexibility that makes HSAs great. It's why more employers are choosing it. It's why more employees are choosing it and surprisingly finding it great, is that they have that flexibility. Let them do it. You don't need to mandate it. That is exactly the point. That is exactly the point. I appreciate your effort here, I really do, and I appreciate, particularly appreciate the focus on HSAs and high deductibles. I think it's something we need to explore further as we try to solve healthcare coverage issues for the state and save money, which we need to do. But this adds cost. It will add cost, and it reduces flexibility. Two of the greatest hallmarks of what this product does, or these products do.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just for the committee, as we have been moving through this session, we have been hearing a lot of and getting a lot of information about the hospitals, and they're struggling with finances as a result of the high deductible plans, and people presenting to the hospitals without the means to pay for their care. So while I understand that there's affection for and a place for these plans, I think we also have to pay attention to what we're seeing happen in the care delivery system and its underfinancing as a result. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, I just came from the bonding committee where we looked at the bonding abilities of hospitals, and basically they don't have any bonding ability anymore. Financial situation of our hospitals is so tenuous that they are all having trouble borrowing money to build additions they need, and about two-thirds of the hospitals in the state have stopped or delayed any plans for any expansions that they because they don't have the money and they can't borrow the money. And if you think high deductibles are a great program, you ought to go to your hospital administrator and ask them about their uncompensated care, which is about three times as much in the last quarter of the past year as it was the year before that. So we're seeing huge numbers of people coming to our federally qualified clinics that have insurance but can't afford the deductible, so they're showing up and trying to get free care at our qualified clinics. I think we need a different approach to medicine, and I think what we're seeing is that the consumer-directed healthcare and HSAs and high deductibles are destroying our healthcare system in this country.
Representative Abel. Well, just to offer a little ray of hope, on the last bill on the calendar for today was a bill to make it easier for hospitals and providers to collect out of HSAs. So.
They said we deleted that section from the bill.
Serious?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind. Would have been a good idea, Mr.
Everybody that has HSAs hates that idea for the same reasons that they're testifying against Representative Loeffler's idea. So,
Representative Loeffler, closing comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, once again, does not limit choice in the market. It does limit who qualifies for tax subsidies from our tax budget, and it promotes prevention and catching people's health problems early when they're less expensive, and I think it's a wonderful way to address health care cost containment. And I'd urge a positive vote. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Loffler will renew her motion that House File 705 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed. And not amended, right, as passed. Okay, this is what we're going to do. We're obviously not going to have time for the next bill. Next week, Representative Huntley has been generous with his committee time. We're going to have Tuesday and Wednesday both committees starting at 1 o'clock, although on Tuesday we'll start at 1:30. Wednesday we'll start at 1 o'clock and go right through 4:15 or 4:20. We have 21 bills that we're going to hear next week, members. So we'll post them today. And if you have questions and clarifications, talk to the authors so we don't have to spend a lot of time in committee getting stuff clarified. Read the bills in advance. And people in the audience, 2 minutes, narrow down your testimony, opposition, or pro or con to the essence of it so that we don't have to spend a lot of time and we can have time for questions if people have that. And we are adjourned. Thank you.